Coming up on this week's show, a budget Mega Drive flash cart arrives.
An amazing new Contra-like game is set to launch.
And we chat to one of the creators of the Macintosh, Apple legend Andy Hertzfeld.
And the Retro Hour podcast is brought to you each and every week with our lovely friends at Bitmap Books. Now, have you seen their latest volume, Run and Gun, A History of On-Foot Shooters? Now, this goes over 496 pages. More than 300 games are in here, all the big ones, Contra, Gunstar Heroes, Metal Slug, Midnight Resistance, Turrican, and some hidden gems that you may not have come across before. We'll talk more about that in just a bit, but you can check it out on the rest of their retro gaming collection at bitmapbooks.com. And with our friends at PCBWay. Now, I'm sure you've heard about PCBWay before. They offer fully featured custom PCB prototyping, low-cost, fast turnaround quality boards, and if you're looking for someone to do services like 3D printing and injection molding, they've got you covered. And check out their incredible retro community page on their website. They're big supporters of the retro community. You can get an instant quote right now for your project at PCBWay.com. Hello and welcome to the Retro Hour podcast, episode number 440, your weekly dose of retro gaming and technology news with me, Dan Wood.
Me, Ravi Abbott.
And me, Joe Fox.
And very nice to be joining us for our first episode of August already. Just realised, only 60 episodes away from episode 500.
Oh man, yeah, literally just over a year away from episode 500, that's crazy.
Where do the weeks go?
We have got
a podcast this week to focus on before we get to episode 500. Nice to be joining us, of course. This is a show that comes out every single Friday and brings you up to speed on all the big happenings in the world of retro gaming and technology from over the last week. We always say it's a show of two halves, really, isn't it? First half of the podcast is when us nerds geek out about what's been happening in the world of retro gaming and tech from over the last 7 days, and we're the guys that keep an eye on all the blogs and the social media sites because we know everyone's busy. So we give you basically the headlines of what's been happening over the last week. And then the second half of the show is when we welcome on an industry veteran to tell us their story. Now, I've got to say, they do not come much bigger than our guest this week. Now, we're going to be talking to Andy Hertzfeld, who is a name that, if you've studied the history of personal computing, it might not be a name that instantly jumps to mind. I mean, you know, you normally think like Steve Jobs, Bill Gates, but he was very important. And actually, I've been reading his website, folklore.org, which if you haven't seen that, it's got some incredible stories about the early days at Apple, because Andy was actually one of the original developers of the Apple Macintosh. So he joined Apple back in 1979. He was a systems programmer and quickly became a core member of the original Mac team. And the thing about it is, back then, I mean, you think about the history of personal computing. Today, we're all used to graphical user interfaces. For example, you know, if I think of even using a DOS PC back in the day, the fact you had to go on and, you know, type in commands to navigate your files and folders.
It wasn't very user-friendly, was it?
Not at all. And I mean, you know, not even just talking about DOS PCs. Over here in the UK, when we had stuff like, you know, the ZX Spectrum and the Commodore 64, that early wave of home microcomputers, they dropped you into BASIC when you first turned them on. So it was assumed that the user would have at least a basic knowledge of programming or be able to read the manual and memorize commands. Then obviously the graphical user interface came along, and that's been the de facto way of using computing ever since. So that was a lot of the stuff that Andy worked on at Apple. It was really making sure that the machine was a user-friendly computer for the end user. And it really made the, you know, personal computer became accessible.
Yeah, and it was a really interesting time. So, you know, we talked to Andy in this interview about when he joined, and it was, you know, the Apple II, which was a great kind of expandable machine. And then, of course, going into the Apple Lisa, and, you know, that was one of the first machines with a GUI that was a home computer.
And it cost $10,000. So
and it cost quite a lot, yeah. And then into the Apple Macintosh, which, you know, we've seen lots of films about Apple and the history of Steve Jobs and hearing about those times and the kind of changes that happened within the company. Some people love Steve. Some people weren't the biggest fans of Steve. So we hear Andy's kind of personal views of this. And I remember seeing Andy also in Michael Fassbender's Steve Jobs film as well.
And, the Danny Boyle one.
Yeah, Andy said it was nothing you know, it wasn't related to how it happened. That film was not aiming for realism, really. But it's really interesting to hear his story, especially during that time, because he worked at General Magic later, which were an absolutely fantastic company that were pushing technology and, you know, helping create the basis for stuff like the iPhone. You know, they were researching emojis. There was all sorts of kind of crazy projects coming out of that company. And it's really interesting to hear about when Steve Jobs left and when John Sculley came in. Yeah, it's a really fascinating interview.
Yeah, I mean, I think hearing about those early days at Apple, because I mean, he runs a website, I mentioned folklore.org that I'll put in the show notes, where you can read a load of anecdotes about that time and the fact that they were, you know, the hours they were working to get the Macintosh launched. I mean, there's famously these T-shirts they wore that said 90 hours a week and loving it. You know, it was said that they weren't 90
hours. Started the crunch there, isn't it?
Yeah. Yes, it's like, you know, just insane the work they went through to get this machine on the market, and then how Steve Jobs suddenly came to him just before the launch, after I think he'd been awake 48 hours, and said, "You're not finished yet. We need a demo to launch the machine with." So you hear all about that. And of course, Steve Jobs' famous reality distortion field. We get Andy's thoughts on that. And like you said, when he went to work for General Magic, basically making what was, you know, the smartphone back in the early 90s.
Yeah.
And how that kind of fell apart. So, and how different things could have been. So whether you're an Apple fan or not, or whether you just want to hear some of this history, how things became how they are today, a really interesting guest. Andy Hertzfeld is our special guest, and he'll be on the podcast in around half an hour from now. Now, I did say first half of the show, that's when we have a bit of a chat, a bit of a round table about what's been happening in retro from over the last week. And this headline I thought was really interesting. And I must admit, I'd like to know a bit more about this story, because this is Crix, who I'm sure many people in the console scene are familiar with. Crix. He's the guy behind those EverDrive cartridges, of which I'm looking now. There's at least three of my machines in front of me with his cartridges in. And these are basically flash carts. So you download ROMs, which I'm sure you legally own. That is a little disclaimer. And put these ROMs on an SD card. You then put them into the top of a cartridge, into your original console. You get a big list of games, and you can play them on original hardware, as if you're running off the original cartridge. But the only thing about them is, I mean, you know, they generally cost around $100 to $150. Mm. But this is something new from him that he's calling a budget ROM cart for the Mega Drive, which is going to be $40.
The three of us were actually debating this
for about half an hour.
For a good half an hour before we started recording. It seems very, very interesting and very affordable, as you say, Dan. $40, this one's going to be. But there is a statement on the official product page. There are no fancy features that modern cartridges usually have. So don't buy this device unless you are sure you understand what it is. So I was a bit like, oh, brilliant. Dan and Ravi will know what this is when I saw this. And as we would have it, I'm not saying that we don't know what it is, but we've all kind of got a little bit of a different opinion on what it is. But what it looks like to me is it's a very basic EverDrive cartridge, so it doesn't have any like FPGA on there.
I think all the other ones did other features, didn't they? So they had like, you know, you could play games that weren't available for the system that would be powered, like, you know, Sega CD games, 32X and stuff like that. And they also had quite a hefty price tag with that as well, didn't they?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so this looks to us, it's a basic one, which uses its own memory. So it doesn't have its own processor on there or anything like that. It uses the memory of the cartridge and the memory of the Sega Mega Drive. But it does have an SD slot on there, which you would think, okay, you put all your games on the SD card and then you stick it in there. But the way it's reading in terms of the product notes is it does only, we're not too sure, this is where we want to find out. Maybe somebody can help us with this one. Does it only put one game on the cartridge?
Yeah, because that was my initial thought, was when I saw this is going to be $40. And a lot of the comments are saying that. If you look through the thread on X, unfortunately, Crix hasn't answered anyone who's asked about this in the thread that I was reading. People are saying, I assume this can only run one game at a time. And I thought, is it something like there's like a skunk board that you can get from Atari Jaguar, but where basically you've got to flash the onboard memory with just one game using a computer by USB. Then you put that cartridge into your Jaguar and it loads that one game that's in memory. But like you said, the fact that this has got an SD card slot on there. That is leading me to think that, well, surely you can put more than one game on there and have it launching from a menu. Like,
this is what I personally think. I'm trying to read between the lines with some of the stuff there. I think it hasn't got all that support. It hasn't got stuff for SRAM saves as well for multiple games. It won't have any support for the special chips or anything. It's your bare bones basic one. But also that doesn't mean you can go through a menu, quickly select them, load up one, load up the other. I've read online that it could take at least a minute for it to kind of go onto there. So I think maybe you can have multiple games on the SD card, load them up, takes a minute for them to load, and then they're in the RAM of the system. You can play on them. If you want to do another one, probably a hard reset on your machine and then load up the next game like that, but do it very like slowly and
which is fine.
Manually.
I mean, if that is the case, then $40 for that, you know, basically if you can have all your Mega Drive games on a cartridge, on an SD card, load them straight into RAM, I think that is an absolute game changer. If it's $40 for something that can only store one game at a time, though, I can see that there's going to be a market there for homebrew developers.
Yeah, I can't see, I guess you can have one SD card for every game and then you'd have this huge like stack like floppy disks.
That wouldn't make any sense, but literally all the comments on X that I'm going through, people are like, oh, I assume it can only have one game at a time. Yeah,
maybe they'll probably have this answered by the time we release the show.
Yeah, probably.
As usual, and then we'll be like, oh, okay.
A lot of people are asking it, so that is definitely something we'd like clearing up, because I think, for example, you, Joe, you haven't got any flash cards for any of your systems, which always amazes me, but then I do understand that they are very expensive for what they are. I mean, I must admit, I did kind of get a lot of mine sent as review units on my YouTube channel like 10 years ago. But yeah, I mean, for something like this that is, you know, $40, would this be something that would get you into the world of flash carts then?
If it does what Ravi thinks it's going to do in terms of game changing and in terms of, you know, you load one game into it at a time, but they're all there on the SD card and it just takes a minute or whatever, then yeah, like like you say, it's a lot more affordable. But then it's so confusing because on the time extension article here, this cart will allow homebrew developers to produce physical cartridges cheaply, either for sale or testing purposes. So then that alludes to what you're worried it is, and it is just a one game.
But then also it's open ed, so it's open source, which is really cool, and made in Ukraine as well. And I was just thinking, like, open ed means this can develop. You know, maybe it will start off as a slower, smaller thing. More people contribute to the project. There'll be, you know, new firmware that can go on there, or they can flash it in a certain way that it will start to do other things and have new functions. And I think that's the cool thing about open source projects as well.
Yeah, I think if this is going to allow people to basically play their list of games off an SD card on their Mega Drive using a $40 flash cart, I think that is a real game changer. And I think, you know, it will open up the market to a lot more people. So fingers crossed, that is what it is. Like we said, details are very scant at the moment. But if you want to read more about that, I think, like you said, Ravi, the fact that it is totally open source as well.
Yeah.
I imagine even if it can't do that at this stage, it probably won't be long until someone makes a version of it that can, if I'm honest. So if you want to check that out, we'll put that. What we know so far, just dropped it the day that we record this. We'll put that in the show notes at theretrohour.com and on your podcast app. Now, I bet this is a game that you're eagerly anticipating. This is a new Contra-like game that is coming out on modern platforms. This is called Iron Meat, and this is set to land. It said September 26th. I thought it was ages away. Next month. It's August now. Yeah,
not far. Yeah. So we did touch on this back in May 2023 when it was first announced, and it was meant to launch October last year. So been eagerly awaiting this one. This looks like a really pumped up modern version of the original Contra games, and modern Contra games, you know, they're not the greatest games, unfortunately. There was one that came out earlier this year. I've not checked that one out, but they tend to get a bad rap. But this Iron Meat looks absolutely fantastic.
More like Contra NES style gameplay by the looks of it.
Yeah, more like Contra NES gameplay, maybe more like Alien Wars, the third one for the Super Nintendo. Really, really, really nice modern pixel art. Looks absolutely brutal, like really gory, kind of gameplay-wise. fighting monsters, aliens, etc. all very bio-organic, mixed with metal, etc. With a real pumping metal soundtrack, which really gets me going whenever I watch the trailer.
It looks very Turrican-y to me as well.
Yeah, yeah, like, yeah.
You know, with some of the spinning attacks and stuff. And I didn't play Contra as much, but, you know, it also looks a bit like Broforce.
Yeah, you might actually be a bit closer with Turrican there, because I always found Turrican a little bit faster, and this is a little bit faster than Contra, I would say.
And the way that he's kind of aiming the weapons, but also when it's zooming out, you know, some of the graphics are absolutely gorgeous, and that kind of huge play field that you had with Broforce as well, it's got that kind of vibe. You know, this is a good thing about these modern titles, they can really push it, can't they?
Yeah, absolutely. It is going to be on everything, like Dan says. PS4, PS5, Xbox, Steam, you know, Switch, Epic Games, GOG, everything in September. So, yeah, only a month and a half, 2 months for this one.
And it's Retroware, isn't it? So
yeah, Retroware as well. Being developed by, I'm going to ruin this, Ivan Vilarevich Savurov. Or Ivan Meat, which I love.
Stick with that, Joe.
Yep. He's the lead program on this. I'm going to keep an eye out for some of these games because this looks absolutely fantastic. I'm going to be picking this one up. It is also going to be coming out on... Is it coming out on physical?
It is, yeah. Strictly Limited. I'm going to be releasing it.
Dan can't play this because he's a vegetarian, but...
Strictly Veg. I'll wait for that version. But I mean, one thing I love about it as well, I mean, you've got the multi-phase boss fights in there as well, like the, you know, the classic run and gun titles. Mm-hmm. There's also multiplayer couch co-op.
Yes.
As well. So, for these kind of games, I mean, it looks like it could be a tough one. I think having a friend on the couch with you playing it, particularly for me, would be quite handy.
You see, I'm desperately trying to find co-op games to play with my wife at the moment because of we've just played everything to death. So whenever a couch co-op game comes out, we're like, yeah, brilliant. But this could end in a divorce, this one. This does look tough, I'm not going to lie. It could end with me screaming at her.
So yeah, that lands end of next month. You haven't got long to wait, so I'll link up the trailer if you want to check that out as well. Now, this is interesting. Now, obviously, the Sega Dreamcast, the VMUs were always quite an interesting concept. The little memory cards that you got in there. And, you know, back in the day, it was often said that you could play games on the VMUs, but they were very simplistic games back then, weren't they? I mean, you know, it's kind of like a little Tamagotchi that you could take around the battery. I remember them running out really quickly as well. However, if it was able to do this back in the day in full colour, this would have been something that everyone would have wanted in the school playground, I imagine. Someone's actually modded a VMU to play Mega Drive games.
Yeah, this looks really cool. So, like you say, the original had the black and grey screen, little LED screen, and, you know, you could play the Chao Garden game on there from Sonic Adventure 2 and stuff like that. Very basic.
Save games as well. That was exciting.
You know, it was there to save your games and look at your health.
Yeah, you get quite good graphics on there. And recently they released the VMU 2 as well, which is kind of an upgraded version that was quite expensive, but it did a lot of interesting things as well. But this is one of those kind of mods, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so this is a Mega Drive inside of a VMU. And for those who aren't familiar with the VMU, they're about the size of a matchbox, probably about, what, an inch and a half tall by about half an inch wide, maybe a little bit bigger than that, aren't they? Not very big at all. And this has been created by modder G Gear Taro. I'm most impressed with the sound quality that's coming out of this thing. So obviously I'm assuming there's a Raspberry Pi in there or something running these emulated Mega Drive games on there with a brand new modern screen in there.
Yeah, because the tweet's in Japanese, isn't it? So getting details of what it is a bit...
Yeah, so it doesn't show any sort of like information of him building it or anything like that, just him playing it. And in the two very short clips, he plays Streets of Rage and then Space Harrier 2. And they play perfectly. And I'm really impressed with the sound that this thing's putting out. He must have put a speaker on the back of it or something. You don't actually see in the video.
It's the only sound I remember the original VMUs making is that...
Yeah, when you load it up and stuff. The battery's dead. So he has crammed a lot into this tiny little VMU device. Interestingly, the Mega Drive had three face buttons. It had the A, B, and C, whereas the VMU only has the D-pad, the very tiny D-pad, and then the A, B, and then sleeping mode. So I imagine mode maybe getting used as the C button there, and then sleep as the pause button.
I don't think it's the nicest thing to play on, and probably Game Gear games will probably be more suited to that kind of screen size, I think.
Yeah, I mean, the I remember the buttons on the VMU being quite rubbery.
Yeah, they're a little bit spongy.
Yeah.
But I think, yeah, I think this is wicked. I think just for a novelty.
It's a nice legacy, you know. You've got Sega Dreamcast, and then you're going back to the Mega Drive and that kind of era. So it's a nice little nod back, isn't it?
Absolutely.
I think, though, yeah, this is nothing that you're going to sit down and, you know, if you want to play Streets of Rage, this is not the way that you choose to play it, admittedly. There are definitely better ways. But this is the kind of thing that if you pulled out, like, you know, a retro gaming convention in the bar afterwards and went, hey, look at this, people are going to be impressed.
Yeah. Yeah, can you imagine that in the nightclub? Hey, baby, want to play some Mega Drive on my VMU?
I've tried worse chat of lines than that joke in the past, trust me. So, yeah, this doesn't very cool, though. We always love to see these ingenious little mods. So, top marks for creativity. If you want to check out those very short videos, I'll put those in this week's show notes as well. Now, this is an interesting little project that you spotted, Ravi, because obviously we're going to be talking all about the Mac in just a moment. And I've seen quite a few of these recently. People are actually doing clone motherboards of retro computers, and this is a clone of the Apple Macintosh Plus.
Yeah, so I've got Apple 512K here, and you know, absolutely nice machine. I've always wanted a Macintosh Plus as well. It's really interesting because these machines are old, you know, they're gonna start to die, and having these recreations of the boards pretty fantastic. I've seen some with the Amiga ones, and the whole idea is, you know, that you kind of get the original chips, you put them in this new board, and then you've got fixes in there. It's going to last a lot longer. Interestingly, there was stuff incorrectly labeled, which usually happens with these boards and manufacturing. You know, real fans will kind of look down into it and they'll be like, oh yes, this is incorrect. And some of those corrections can actually be made. There can be some additions as well. I've seen improvements, newer kind of hardware getting added as well, which can bring some extra life into it. This looks really cool as well because he's using a Raspberry Pi Pico scan converter as well, which works with the Macintosh Plus. And I think it's amazing that the Raspberry Pi can be used as pretty much anything nowadays, and can be used as upscalers and converters and kind of help with your video source from a vintage machine.
I've been to computer events, and particularly your Robinhood Amiga group, Ravi, and there's, you know, people that have opened up Amiga 500s, and there's been like four Raspberry Pis inside them.
Yeah.
Doing all kinds of different things, yeah. But yeah, I do like the idea of this. This is a guy called Quinn Dunkey, who previously actually did a clone of the Apple Lisa. But this one actually looks really cool, though. It is a clone of the 1984 Macintosh Plus, the first clone of it in 34 years. 1 megabyte of RAM, expandable to 4 megabytes of memory as well. And it is completely compatible with all the original software and hardware as well. And it looks like it is literally a drop-in replacement inside the case. So, and I think, yeah, like you said, there have been a few of these. I've seen the Amiga ones as well. Like there's an A4000 Amiga board that's come out recently, isn't there? Where basically, because a lot of these boards, I mean, they get damaged from capacitors leaking, or some of them have like onboard batteries.
Yeah.
They can obviously spew acid all over the boards and eat away traces and that kind of thing. So I think having a modern version of the board where you can basically transplant the original ICs in there and basically have a new computer that is compatible with the original case and should hopefully last you many years to come is very cool.
Yeah. And it's got issues. You know, they were saying that Raspberry Pi Pico scan converter can actually work with it, even though it's reported to. So they ended up using Apple Talk, you know, the remote control software, and Timbuktu to actually access it, which is pretty amazing that you could still kind of use that and get a display out of it. You know, I can imagine that this is going to grow. They're going to, you know, add some extra features in there. It's great to see that this is the first one, and, you know, hopefully we're going to see some more once it's all kind of fixed up and, you know, all the glitches and all this kind of stuff has been sorted. He's likely to release the schematics and you know, hopefully people will start producing these boards and duplicate them as well.
I think the only thing about these, though, is it would be great when it gets to the stage when you can basically build, and there are projects where you can do this, you can build a whole new computer using all new hardware. I think some people have got Commodore 64s now that are doing that. You know, basically it's a new motherboard, it's replacement chips that are in there as well, or FPGAs.
Well, that's the thing, the chips, you know, a lot of them aren't getting made anymore. So, yeah, you know, the tracers go, and then it's when will the chips go? So, yeah, having those replacements, hopefully you can keep using these machines that you love for years.
Yeah, well, outlast us, I'm sure. So if you want to check out that, the clone of the 1984 Apple Macintosh Plus, I'll put that in the show notes as well. Now, just one last story to talk about before we chat to this week's very special guest going inside the world of Apple with Apple legend Andy Hertzfeld in just a second. And now this, I must admit, I wasn't familiar with this game, but this is an unofficial sequel of a game called Kenseiden, which apparently is a bit of a cult classic for the Sega Master System, but someone's actually made this an unofficial sequel of this, spiritual sequel for the Mega Drive.
I am also unaware of Kenseiden. I'm not very familiar with many Master System games, to be perfectly honest. It's a system I really want to get into more because obviously I love the Mega Drive, the Saturn.
Do you have a Master System?
I have a Master System. I have a one. Funny enough, I have the Master System one. I don't have the two.
I have the two and of the one.
Oh, there we go.
Swap for a weekend.
And I have about 10 games for it because I went for a small phase of trying to get like games that came out on the Mega Drive and the Master System to kind of compare them, but realized quickly that it'll be a really big feat because of actually quite a lot of them came out on the Master System as well. But anyway.
Have you got any, well, we're talking about Master System Model 1, have you got any of the games that came out on memory cards?
I haven't, no. My friend Jason has them all. Right. He has the whole set of the card games because I think there's only about 10, so it's not too hard to get the entire set. But yeah, this is Hayato's Journey, which looks absolutely fantastic. It is the first Mega Drive game, complete Mega Drive game, to have been made on the Scorpion engine, and it's been made by a developer called Master Lin Kuei. There's a 6-minute trailer. The game is already out for download, so you can download this now and go grab it. It looks absolutely phenomenal, this game does. It looks absolutely fantastic. Like, the soundtrack for this is so, like, it's so Mega Drive. In terms of gameplay, very similar to Shinobi, but I would say a little bit faster, the Shinobi to the Mega Drives. A little bit more floaty, maybe a little bit more user-friendly in terms of like jumping around and fighting, etc. Watched the whole trailer and I noticed a few assets from other games, so I actually went and took a little bit of a dive, and interestingly the sprite work and stuff that he's used in the game actually come from many other games in different systems, such as ActRaiser, which was actually a Super Nintendo game, as well as Revenge of Shinobi, Shinobi 3, Super Empire Strikes Back, the Star Wars game for Super Nintendo, Willow as well, which I think was an arcade game, might have been on SNES as well. So lots of different elements from different games, but I think graphically this looks absolutely, it looks so good. It looks so good, and it just kind of shows what Scorpion, what people are doing on the Scorpion engine at the moment.
You know, we've talked about the Scorpion engine before, that really, you know, on the Amiga in particular.
Episode 326 we had Iraq on.
We did, yeah. And it's basically a game development tool, isn't it, for retro systems. Started on the Amiga, works on other 68K platforms as well, including obviously now the Mega Drive as well. And just the things they're doing with this. I mean, there's a comment here on the article that the Scorpion engine is the gift that keeps on giving. And I think it's just been such a game changer for retro development. The games that we're seeing that coming out on this now, I mean, if these had come out on the market when these machines were in their heyday 30 years ago, it's like, you know, it would have expanded the life of them, I think, a few years, wouldn't it, after the PlayStation came out, even.
Absolutely. There's talk of it coming out on the Amiga as well as the Neo Geo. I think graphically this game, if you saw this running on the Neo Geo and you just assumed it was an old school Neo Geo game from the 90s, you would just, it looks that good. I think you would just go, that's a Neo Geo game, not a Mega Drive game. It's absolutely fantastic.
Yeah, the things they're doing with the Scorpion engine and, you know, these talented developers now never ceases to amaze us. It's one of those name your own price games as well. So, you know, pay what you think it's worth. But yeah, looks like it should be a great little blast if you want to play over the summer. So I'll link that up. And of course, everything else we talk about in our show notes at theretrohour.com. Now, we did have a great patrons hangout over the weekend. Another fantastic chat. If you haven't heard of these before, these are something that we do every single month with our patrons. And we did two this month, actually, didn't we? On the start of the month, one at the end as well, where we all get together on a Sunday night for a couple of hours and basically just have a massive geek out about anything and everything.
Yeah, man. It always starts off talking about some retro games, etc. But the one that we did this Sunday just gone, I was loving it. We're all talking about horror films that traumatized us as children.
Yes.
Which opened up
Nightmare on Elm Street, watching that when I was 8 years old with my babysitter.
Yeah, that was a really, really
Watership one. Down, that was one.
Oh, yeah.
That,
there you go.
Throw me every time. That
was a scary one, actually. Yeah, man. Like, it's just like hanging out with friends. Like, sometimes I wish we could just do it in the pub. But
we will one day.
We will one day. But honestly,
hopefully we'll be able to in Norway as well with some people.
Yeah. But yeah, people from all over the world, you know, come on. And it's just absolutely fantastic. I love it.
Yeah, so that is one of the perks that we give our patrons who support the podcast and help us keep the lights on and help us bring new episodes out every single week. If you like what we do, you know, think of it as a little tip jar. It really helps us out with all the running costs and everything as well. We give a few extra perks as well. You sometimes get the episode early if I can get it edited in time. You get it ad-free as well. And also we do an extra 10 to 15 minutes of news stories on every single episode just for our patrons. So patrons, stand by. That's coming up for you in just a minute. But if you'd like to join our patrons community and help us out with the running costs of the show, all the details are at theretrohour.com. And speaking of people who help us out with the podcast, let's just take a quick second to give a massive shout to our longest running sponsor, a company that we love working with. 6 years we've been working with our incredible friends at Bitmap Books. And it is a partnership that we've absolutely thoroughly enjoyed. I mean, we're really behind the incredible books that they put out. And, you know, it just seems like every book that Bitmap Books put out is even better than the last one, incredibly.
They're like a piece of art, you know. When I read one, I'm like, I need to wash my hands, I need to sit down, I need to
put your gloves on,
open it slowly. Yeah, and I think that's quite good that they give a free PDF as well with the hardback book, because then I'm like, right, I can use this on my tablet, look at it piece, because it's really like you know, kind of therapeutic to sit there with this thing with the beautiful visuals and just take it all in and, you know, enjoy reading again.
Yeah, absolutely. And keep the original in nice condition and look at the PDF on your tablet. Although I've got to say, opening their books and that smell, you know, the freshly printed smell that comes off the pages. Oh, love that. But their new one, though, and again, you know, it's been a very Joe Fox heavy episode this week. This looks right up your street, though. This is a history of on-foot shooters called Run and Gun.
Yeah, man, this looks absolutely incredible. Almost 500 pages, this book is. Starting with the humble beginnings of gunfight in 1975, and then covers the next 40 years of run and gun foot shooters. There's just so many games in here, but it covers all the Mega Man games, all the Metal Slug games, you name it, it's probably going to be in there, all the way up to modern games such as one of my favorites, Cuphead, and also the Hotline Miami games are in there as well, Turrican, Contra, Super Star Wars games, Smash TV. There's so many games covered in this. And what I love about the Bitmap books is it's not too much. It's not over the top. You get some really nice, lovely images and artwork of the games, and then a page or two about the game as well, which I think is absolutely fantastic. If you just want to pick it up and just read a few pages of it every time, because it really is a coffee table book.
Yeah, they're really accessible, and they've got some contributions in there from industry legends, Sega Lord X, Graham Mason, Chris Scullion's in here as well, and like you said, covers over 300 games across 496 gorgeous pages. So if you love your run and gun games, this is the ultimate love letter to that genre, and it is available right now. You can check it out and have a look at the rest of their books as well. Let them know that we sent you. You know, it always really helps out the podcast as well. Support our sponsors. Run and Gun, a history of on-foot shooters, available right now at bitmapbooks.com. So thank you for checking out the news on this week's podcast. Of course, all the stories we talked about will be in your show notes. Have a look on your podcast app, or you can click through directly from our website at theretrohour.com. Right then, stand by. We have got a true legend on the podcast next, a veteran of the computer industry, with Apple superstar Andy Hertzfeld is next on the Retro Hour podcast. You're listening to the Retro Hour podcast, and it is time to welcome on this week's very special guest, and anyone who knows anything all about Apple. And of course, the history of personal computing. I'm sure we'll be familiar with our guest this week. He's known for a pivotal role in the development of the original Apple Macintosh, joining Apple in 1979, and that quickly became a core part of the Macintosh team, contributing to the implementation of the system software in particular, and later went on to join and co-found one of the most innovative, forward-looking tech companies ever, General Magic. So we'll get into all of that, I'm sure, with our guest this week, Andy Hertzfeld. How's it going, Andy?
Good.
Thank you for coming on and hopefully doing some reminiscing with us. Hopefully, bring back some memories of those early days at Apple over the next hour or so. But I'm interested, it's a question that we always like to ask our guests at the start, is basically what started your interest and your passion? I mean, do you remember initially what got you into computers and technology, where that journey began?
Yeah, there was a class in high school in 10th grade. They didn't, in those days, of course, computers were pretty hard to find, but they had a terminal that was hooked up into a GE time-sharing system about 10 miles away. And I took my first class and just fell in love with computers and programming.
You ended up studying at UC Berkeley as well. And
yeah, that's a grad student.
Yeah. And what kind of like machines were around there?
UC Berkeley then, it was PDP 1170 was the main computer used by the computer science department. But while I was there, they switched over to a VAX, which is also digital equipment, a later, more powerful computer. No personal computers, though, at all in 1976 there.
When did you kind of first hear of Apple, and when did you decide to get an Apple II?
Well, the first time I saw an Apple II was when it debuted at the first West Coast Computer Fair in April 1977. I saw it at the booth and I was immediately drawn to it because of its color graphics, its innovative design in so many ways. As I was saying, I didn't have enough money to afford one in those days. When it debuted there, it was $1,800 for a 4K machine. Yeah. And that was more than I had in the bank. But later in January 78, they had a $400 off sale for the Apple II, for 16K Apple II. And I was able to afford that. So I got one and immediately became obsessed with it. I thought it was the best purchase I've made in my life. I still think that today.
And what kind of things were you doing with your Apple II at home then when you first got the machine?
Well, just I was obsessed with getting to the bottom of how it worked. So I started writing little assembly language programs. Before, one of the main catalysts was there was a users group that I was a founding member of starting in April 1978. It met once a month. And before each meeting, I stayed up for hours and hours into the morning, getting whatever programs I had written that month in good enough shape to give to the club for free. There was, when I started out, there was no market for personal computer software, but it wasn't even well understood if there would ever be a market. Mm. So it was just doing it out of fun and passion and curiosity. And it was amazing. As you guys probably know, Steve Wozniak's design was incredibly innovative. Imagination bursting out of every socket. You know, it was just, and that was a formative experience for me when I saw and understood Woz's work. I thought, well, that's the kind of work I want to do.
Well, you went to work for Apple very early in 1979. So tell us your journey from, you know, being an Apple II enthusiast and being at the club to actually working for Apple itself. And do you remember what the interview was like?
Yeah, well, what happened was, I started developing programs that I gave away to the users group. That I gradually got more ambitious until finally I wrote a systems program that overcame one of the detriments of the Apple II. Believe it or not, the original Apple IIs did not support lowercase letters. Mm. Hard to imagine these days. And so I realized I could use what was called the high-res graphics screen. Today, you know, it's the Apple II screen resolution is about the same as an icon. So it was 280 by 192. But those days, we called that high resolution. But you could use the graphics to draw whatever you wanted, including lowercase letters. So I was able to figure out how to plug it into the system and gave it lowercase letters and color letters, a few other things. Usually what I had been doing up to that point was when I wrote a program that I thought was interesting enough, I'd send it to magazines like Dr. Dobbs Journal. There were all these little tiny magazines springing up to support the nascent personal computer revolution. Anyway, I the highest thing I could think to do with my programs was getting them published in the magazine. But I showed my lowercase letter program to a friend, and he said, don't give it away like that. You could sell it and make tens of thousands of dollars. I said, I don't know how to sell anything. I could never do anything like that. He told me, well, don't worry about it. You just do the programming. I'll do the rest, and we'll split the money for it. So that's what we did. We started taking my little character generator program around to the different tiny little companies that were publishing PC software. And everyone we took it to loved it and wanted to publish it. So we thought, well, you must not be big enough. These were little 2-3 person companies. Until eventually in December of 1978, we had an appointment to show it to Apple, which I worshipped by then. In particular, to show it to Steve Jobs at Apple, who at that time, his title was Vice President of New Products. And so we had some trepidation, though. I was friends with Chris Espinoza, who had taken a leave from Apple to get a degree at UC Berkeley. I met him because I was his teaching assistant in the introductory programming class. I told him we were going to take my character generator program down to Apple and show it to Steve Jobs. He said, watch out. If he doesn't like your program, he'll bite your head off.
Yeah.
I remember he said exactly that, but I wanted to keep my head attached to my neck. But I thought, well, you know, we'll give it a try. And we showed it to Steve, and he was incredibly kind and welcoming to us. He liked my character generator program. We left that day with a deal for Apple to buy it. But then Steve's assistant called me back a week later saying they changed their mind. Apple never did buy it. They had a pretty good excuse, though, which is my program was intended for one of the empty ROM sockets in the Apple II. Apple II had 6K of ROM, and it only used 4K. Maybe my numbers are off because I haven't thought about this for decades. But Apple was already planning the Apple II Plus, which had Microsoft BASIC in those ROM sockets instead of Woz's brilliant Integer BASIC. So they didn't have a slot for it anymore. So the guy told me, well, reluctantly, you know, we're not going to buy your program, but we'd like to hire you. I was pretty excited about that, but I had already put 3 years into a PhD program at UC Berkeley. I thought, well, I should get at least a master's degree. So I delayed interviewing and starting at Apple until the school year was out. But that delay cost me a 4-to-1 split in Apple stock shares. So it was not a prudent thing to do financially. And so I went down, interviewed at Apple, met some of the people, loved everyone, and started work there in August of 1979.
How important do you think the expandability of the Apple II was as well to its
success? Oh, it was crucial. It was crucial. Sort of the biggest single factor in Apple II's early success was the disk drive, Woz's brilliant design for the disk drive. That couldn't have been done if there weren't slots. Another thing was the time came when Apple had to expand the memory in an Apple II. And so slot 0 for the language card, if we didn't have that, we couldn't have gotten sophisticated software in, you know, the midlife of the Apple II. So the slots were crucial, especially because personal computing was still evolving so rapidly. The slots gave it a chance to, you know, keep up with whatever was demanded.
Well, when you initially joined Apple, do you remember the first things you were working on then when you first got there?
Yeah, I was thrilled, actually, when they told me the project they had me slated for, which was a small graphic thermal printer called the Silentype. And I wrote all the firmware for it. What was so thrilling about it was that printer project was doing the exact, very similar thing to what Woz did with the disk drive of the Apple II, which is remove a lot of electronics from the device itself and just use the microprocessor in the Apple II to implement things, which not only made it more flexible, but you could make it faster. It could get better and better over time because the key functionality was in software, not in ROM chips. So it was thrilling to do a very similar thing to what Woz did. And printing is fun, you know, because it's I've always loved graphics. Mm. And so the little graphical printer was a great first project for me.
And very well received as well, wasn't it? I know that's considered one of the finest printers of the year.
At the beginning, they sold tens of thousands of them. What was great was a lot of projects, like the Macintosh, for example, I worked on for over 3 years before it saw the light of day. Whereas with that printer, I started working on it in August, and it was shipping by December, you know, just a few months. So that was great to be able to get a product out into the world, you know, when I was only working at Apple at that point for like 5 months.
Well, we'll get onto the Mac in a moment, because obviously, you know, such an important product for Apple, completely changed the company. But before that, there was the Apple Lisa, which was the first Apple machine to feature a graphical user interface after those famous Xerox PARC meetings. I mean, what memories have you got of those early days of when you first saw a graphical user interface? And was there much buzz around Apple in general about the Lisa project and the GUI?
Yeah, definitely. It was considered to be one of the pillars of Apple's future. First time I saw a graphical user interface, I remember pretty clearly it was in the pages of a magazine, the September 1977 issue of Scientific American had a long essay by Alan Kay detailing and a lot of screenshots of the Altos graphical user interface. Mm. So that was a thrilling glimpse of the future. But when I started at Apple, I was there a week or two when Bill Atkinson, who was the main person doing the UI and the graphic software for the Lisa, came by my desk. He had heard that I was really interested in fonts, proportional fonts. I had written a proportional font editor for the Apple II, and I had downloaded some fonts that were developed at MIT. And in those days, it was really rare to find good proportional fonts. So Bill came by and showed me the work he was doing on the Lisa, drawing with proportional fonts. I gave him some of my fonts to use as well. But that was my first glimpse of it. I was still working on the Apple II, but I thought Lisa was an incredible advance. Lisa was way too expensive, was sort of the Achilles heel. What the Macintosh was doing in large part was an affordable version of Lisa's, a version that could be truly personal. Lisa came out, ended up costing about $10,000 when it came out. That's not very personal. Most people couldn't afford that. So the Macintosh was, we called it the computer for the rest of us. Not only was it affordable, but it was easy enough for an ordinary person to use.
Well, when did you first become aware of the Macintosh project and how were you brought on board?
Well, I became aware of it when Bill showed me the prototype software he was working on. I came on board when Apple, there was a famous day in Apple's history was called Black Wednesday, when Mike Scott, the CEO of the time, fired about a quarter of the Apple II group suddenly, because he felt that Apple had made some bad hires and it was getting bureaucratic. My boss was fired, essentially. So I was sort of freed up. I had already become friends with Burl Smith, who did the hardware for the original Mac, and Bud Tribble, who was working on the software. And so I thought, well, maybe this mass firing is my opportunity to start on the Mac project, which only had four people working on it at the time. I was pretty disillusioned by the mass firing, especially because they fired a few people I thought were excellent engineers. But Mike Scott, who did the firing, heard that I was disillusioned. He called me to his office and said, well, we don't want to lose you. What can we do to make you stay? And I said, well, maybe I could work on the Mac project, Burl and Bud. Later that afternoon, Steve Jobs came by, who had just taken over the Mac project. And he asked me if, or I had a conversation with him. The first thing he said to me, "Are you any good? We only want people, great people to work on the Mac. I'm not sure you're good enough." He went, though, and talked to Burl and Bud, and they said, "Oh, no, this guy's pretty good." So he came back to my cubicle late on a Thursday afternoon, like maybe about 5 p.m., and he said, "Congratulations, you're working on the Mac now." I said, "Well, just give me till Monday." This was on a Thursday, late Thursday. I wanted to get just the project I was working on in order enough for someone to pick it up so that the work wouldn't be wasted. But Steve said, you know, I told him I was working on this new operating system for the Apple II. When he asked, he goes, "That the Apple II, you shouldn't work on the Apple II. The Apple II will be obsolete in a couple of years. You know, you got to start on the Mac." I said, "Just give me a day." He goes, "No." And he went and pulled the plug on my Apple II, lifted it up, and started walking away with it. All I could do was follow him. He got into his car. He put the Apple II in the trunk. We drove to a little building, just a few minutes, you know, about four blocks from the main Apple building. Took the computer out of the trunk, walked up to the second floor, and dropped it on a desk, saying, "Here's your new desk." Then he just sort of disappeared. I started looking at the desk, and it had no, it's previous owner hadn't moved out of it yet. The drawers were filled with all kinds of interesting little things like model airplanes and radio-controlled cars, toy cars. But it turns out he had put me at Jeff Raskin's desk, who he had just fired a day or two before. Mm. But that was my start on the Mac project.
What were the team dynamics like? Because I heard, you know, there was famously an us and them kind of attitude around the Mac and the rest of the teams at Apple.
Well, actually, yeah, it developed into that. But at the beginning, there wasn't that. No one believed in the Mac project. The Mac project was a skunk works. It only had a few people. By that time, the Lisa team had like 50 people. The Apple II team had probably like 70 people. We were just a very small group. Even though it was led by Steve, he didn't have nearly the reputation that he had today. You know, people thought really that Woz was the genius behind Apple, and Steve was lucky. Actually, one of the first biographies or stories, books written about Apple called Steve, The Accidental Millionaire. You know, it shows he wasn't that respected at the time. But then as we made progress on the Mac and got more things going, and we had a run of 50 prototypes built that we gave out to various places in the company, I would say by early 1982, the Mac sort of got more on, people started believing in it more. And that's when there was a little bit of contention between the different groups. The Mac was priced like an Apple II with the features of Lisa. So both of those bigger groups had reason to not want the Mac to succeed. But we just, you know, kept moving forward. And eventually, you know, the Lisa came out in January of 1983. By the middle of 1983, it was clear that it wasn't going to live up to expectations. And so the Mac became more of a central focus of Apple in the last year before it shipped. And so, you know, there were still little animosities, but as more and more of Apple believed in us and counted on us, we became more mainstream at Apple.
How did Steve Jobs' reality distortion field influence the Macintosh project?
Well, Steve could convince anyone of almost anything, and that was an incredible asset to have. But of course, you know, Steve also could be a pretty hard taskmaster. Steve's relationship to the project, he had corporate responsibility, so he ended up coming to the little building with the Mac team in the late afternoon, early evenings. We'd always show him what we were working on. He'd tell us, you know, gossip or, you know, stuff that happened that he thought we should be interested in. But he'd be very critical of the work you were doing. sometimes he was kind of binary. Either it was incredibly great or it was awful. And there weren't very many points in between that. You know, but he certainly spurred people on to doing their best possible work. The first thing that I heard, Bud Tribble coined that phrase, the reality distortion field, and he explained it to me on my first day of work that Steve would, actually, it was for the schedule. Bud was telling me what the planned schedule was. This was in February of 1981. We were supposed to finish and ship by early 82, you know, like 8-9 months, which was clearly preposterous. I said, Bud, you know, that's ridiculous. We'll never be able to do that. And he said, I know. I said, you know, well, how come you don't fix the schedule if you know that it's way off base? And he said, well, it's Steve. Steve had a reality distortion field. He could, you know, make things happen out of sheer force of will. And so, you know, the reality distortion field, which is really just a fanciful name for Steve's amazing powers of persuasion. But that helped us transcend our limitations and work harder than ever. And finally, you know, Steve wanted us to do the greatest thing possible or even greater. And we did it, more or less.
He had a huge charisma.
Yeah, charisma. And, you know, he's also creative, inventive. Had a great sense of humor, but could also be really tough.
How do you describe your working relationship with Steve? And did were there any kind of encounters that really stand out from that time? Any memories that you've got?
Yeah, I always got along with him pretty good. The only disappointment was I ran, as the Mac team grew, we hired some managers, and one of the software manager didn't like me. Partially because I had a good relationship with Steve, and he felt Steve was interfering by coming around to the software group and talking to them every night. He couldn't manage us that well. He couldn't stay late because he had a young child at home. He ended up giving me a bad review for the time period I was doing key work on the Macintosh because he thought I was insubordinate. And Steve had promised to, when Bud Tribble, who was the first software manager on the Mac project. And Bud was incredibly great to work with. He'd always be able to improve, give me suggestions to improve whatever it was I was doing. But we were really disappointed. Bud had to leave at the end of 1981. So he was in an MD-PhD program at the University of Washington. And he had to leave to keep up his standing in the program. So when Bud left, Steve promised he would. I was afraid we'd get a bad boss. Steve promised to protect us from that, but later didn't fulfill that when that situation actually arose. So that was some friction I had with Steve. But I stayed friends with Steve, you know, through the years. I used to see him at least a few times a year. You know, I was fine at getting along with him, mainly because we just had a common goal of doing the greatest thing we possibly could do.
Well, I was wondering how the concept of the GUI evolved, especially during the development of the Macintosh.
Well, we didn't believe in designs on paper. We had to prototype things to see how they worked. And so we just, you know, sort of one step at a time, each new thing we added would fit into the system and give you other ideas of things to do. So just over time, we made it as good as we possibly could. All kinds of little discoveries on the way. Whenever we thought of a better way of doing it, we scrambled to get things in there. Even though we had these onerous schedules, it was even more important to just make the best possible thing we could. And of course, the team grew over time. I was the second software person to work on the Mac after Bud. By 1983, we had almost a dozen programmers or so.
And obviously, a big selling point of the Mac initially was that it was a computer that was friendly to use. I mean, there was that famous quote from Bill Gates when he was developing software for the Mac that it was the only machine he'd let his mother use.
Yes. Alan Kay had a great quote about Macintosh, which it was the first personal computer that was worth criticizing.
Right. Nice. But even stuff like, you know, the Finder now today, we still got the smiley Apple face. I mean, was that a real core design element then to make the machine friendly and accessible?
Yeah, well, we were trying to make it as friendly and unintimidating as possible. Susan Kerr, who was my friend from high school, who we hired to do graphics for the Mac, she started January 1983. And one of the things I loved about Susan, not only her intellect, but her sense of humor. I just said, oh, we need a little icon to display as it's booting to show that it passed the hardware tests we do on boot. And she came up with the smiling Macintosh and the sad Mac as well. You know, that was two sides of the same inspiration. And we loved it. We actually loved anything that would make it more fun.
Because you bear in mind the competition at the time. I mean, you know, the PC, you know, you turn it on, you were landed at the DOS prompt. So computers really weren't accessible for many people.
We were pretty critical of the PC, and we were trying to make something that was truly great and would be accessible to everyone. You know, I would say Microsoft had very different values than Apple. The goal of all the work that Microsoft did was to make as much money as they possibly could, whereas Steve Jobs viewed himself as an artist, encouraged the team to think of themselves as artists. So we had more artistic values, not so much maximizing our profit, but maximizing the greatness of our product, trying to do the best thing ever. Microsoft wouldn't even care to do the best thing ever. They just wanted to make the most money ever. Whereas the Mac really was motivated by just making something that people would adore.
Well, after the legendary 1984 commercial during the Super Bowl, was the pressure stepped up to deliver even more? And I was also wondering when you first saw that advert. Was it the Super Bowl when you first saw it?
No. We saw it as it was developing. I even they asked me to write a little software that was used in the commercial to flash numbers and letters on the side of the screen. But we heard about it from the very beginning. Try It Day, the advertising company responsible for it that Apple worked closely with. They had already done a series of ads for the Apple II and stuff. But one of the concepts when brainstorming with them about what should the big intro ad be, they had come up for their Apple II work with the slogan, "Why 1984 won't be like 1984. We thought that was a great concept. They did a storyboard. They hired, really good people to shoot it. You know, I was busy working on the software. I wasn't that involved with it, but they had a shoot for the ad, I think in like August of 1983. Shortly after that, they made a rough cut. Steve showed it to the team. Most of us just loved it. But they showed it to the board of directors who hated it. They thought it wasn't product-oriented enough. It didn't hardly mention the Macintosh till the very end. And so they said, we're not going to spend $1 million on this. And they instructed Shy It Day to sell the Super Bowl ad time back. They originally were doing two versions, a 30-second version and a one-minute version. And they sold the 30-second version back, but Shy It Day essentially lied and say that they weren't able to, at this late date, to sell the one-minute time slot, so we had to run it. And, of course, it was a sensation. It was an allegory, a brilliantly shot, staged, creative, and I guess now it's considered one of the best ads of all time.
Well, there is a great image as well on your website, folklore.org. Obviously, we'll talk more about the website and the stories on there soon. But I'm just looking at an image now of the T-shirts and the hoodies that you had made up. The 90 hours a week and loving it. So were you actually working these amount of hours then? I mean, what do you remember about that time then and the intense amount of hours you spent in the office getting the Macintosh project ready for launch?
Well, it evolved over time. I always worked late. Bud Tribble did too. So a lot of the Mac software development was done after dinner. But as we got more and more people, and as the deadline drew closer, people were staying later and later. Ironically, the people who made that sweatshirt were the finance team, who really didn't work anything close to 90 hours. They were more like 40 hours a week and loving it. But the software team, especially in the last few months before shipping, really did work 90 hours or more. I have a funny story in my book about how Burl Smith, when he finally quit Apple, he took some masking tape and crossed out the 9. So his sweatshirt said 0 hours a week and loving it.
Nice.
I thought it was a clever way to resign.
Well, at the Mac's launch, Steve Jobs revealed the machine and had it introduce itself with a speech synthesizer. So how was that idea reached? Thanks. I know you worked on that.
Yeah. Just before, like a week or maybe a week and a half before the launch, we had some software developers come in, and we had seeded them with an early Mac. I forget the name of the company, but I remember the name of the engineer, Mark Barden. They had done a speech synthesizer for the Apple II, and we commissioned them to do it for the Mac. They finally came in with a demo right before it shipped, and it sounded great. And when Steve heard it, he goes, I want the Macintosh to be the first computer to introduce itself. And so my job was to integrate the software. You know, all the hard work was writing the speech engine. I had to plug it into our demo, make it work. And so I had to figure out, well, what should the Mac say? You know, with it introducing itself, I thought it was beyond me to figure out something like that. But Susan had the brilliant idea of calling Steve Hayden, who was the advertising writer who had conceived of the 1984 commercial. We asked him, well, write us some words that should be the Mac's first words introducing. And he did a great job beginning, hello, I am Macintosh. It sure is great to get out of that bag. You know, it was in a bag on stage the whole time Steve was talking. But anyway, the intro demo story was we had worked, you know, if we had worked 90 hours a week on average, the last couple weeks before we shipped, we were probably working 120 hours a week. Wow. The last 3 days, I got no sleep at all. And finally, we got the system disk done and it was driven off to the factory to be mass reproduced. We were just lying on the floor, sighing with relief after working the hardest we ever worked in our lives. We were finally finished, at least for the first release. But then while we were like lounging around on the floor, Steve Jobs came in and said, get up, you're not done yet. And we thought, well, sure, we were done. What else could we do? But he goes, we need a great demo to introduce the Mac with. And so we sort of sighed and were exhausted, but we also were attracted to the challenge of making a great demo. We only had like 5 or 6 days to do it. One of the things at the end was the speech demo we were just talking about, but we also had various other graphics demos and a slideshow of Mac applications and stuff. But during the rehearsals, the demo occasionally crashed. What it really was the huge letters we had scrolling across the screen pushed the memory limits of the 128K Mac. So we had the idea in those days, when the Mac shipped, there were prototype 512K Macs, just two of them we had in all of existence. But we thought, let's use one of those for the demo to make it so it wouldn't crash.
I was wondering then, after the launch, did you have your chance to let your hair down?
Yeah. The launch was just an ecstatic catharsis, you know, the culmination of over 3 years worth of work. So we were just sort of in an exhausted haze, but in heaven. That we did it. We got it out to the stores. One of the things I did right after the introduction ceremony was I wanted to buy. It was supposed to be on sale. Not only was the Macintosh announced that day, but it was supposed to be available that day. So I set my goal, well, to go around to the computer stores and actually buy one just to prove to myself that you could do that. But it turns out none of the stores around had them yet. And finally, I found one that was willing to sell it to me, even though it didn't have it delivered to me for another month. And so I did achieve my goal of at least buying it on the day of introduction. And of course, I already had a few of them that we were using for development, but just it just made it more real to be able to go into a store and actually purchase it.
How were the sales of the Mac after launch?
They started out great. By the summer, Steve set a goal that he mentioned during the introduction of selling 50,000 Macintoshes in the first 100 days. And we exceeded that. We sold about 60,000. And into the summer, it was still doing well. But in the fall of 1984, the computer industry experienced one of its downturn periods. And the sales of the Mac started drying up till by the December month, we had forecast 80,000 to be sold in December of 1983. And in fact, it was selling more like 6,000 instead of 80,000, a huge shortfall. Mm. And so the beginning of 1985, people started panicking. What can we do to fix it? I was on leave of absence from Apple by then, but there was a lot of pressure that, hey, the Mac's not selling. What can we do? And ultimately, that led to Steve getting kicked off the Mac team, which I would have said prior to that, that was impossible to happen. Steve was the heart and soul of the company, leader of the Mac team. That seemed like, very precarious times for Apple.
Do you remember the reaction to that from the team? Because that must have been, like you said, like having the heart and soul of the Mac team.
Well, it was mixed, Steve, because Steve was polarizing. Steve could be the greatest boss you've ever had and the worst boss you've ever had almost simultaneously, So depending on how you felt about Steve, you either thought, oh, Apple is going to get professional management now, or you thought that Apple was going to become a shadow of itself without Steve as the driving force.
Well, you said you had a leave of absence as well in April 84. I was wondering why you decided to leave.
Because I had the bad boss I alluded to a little while ago. I had a boss who gave me an awful review for the time period. I was working harder than I've ever worked before creating the Macintosh user interface toolbox, but he gave me a bad review because I didn't kowtow to him enough. And at that time, with the better, I thought, I can't work for this guy, so I'm going to quit. But then with second thoughts, I thought, well, I can't quit. I put too much of my life into the Mac. It's too important, not just to me, but to everybody. And so I'll stay until it launches. And after it launched and things quieted down a little after the launch, someone suggested to me not to quit, but just go on leave so I'd have the option of coming back. That's what I did. Ended up not coming back because 6 months as my leave was expiring, things were still in bad shape there, in my opinion, which was probably borne out by, Steve getting fired just a few months after that. I still did approximately what I would have done if I was still there, writing the first multitasking environment for the Macintosh called Switcher. I developed a commercial product during that time called ThunderScan. So I was still very, very much an Apple developer, even when I was no longer an employee.
Well, obviously that time was a tumultuous time at Apple, but kind of going forward, a few years, because you did actually work with Apple again when you founded with Bill Atkinson and Mark Porat at the company General Magic. There's an amazing movie that came out about it a couple of years ago.
Yes.
And, the tagline to that was the company who saw the future too soon. Because, you did some incredible innovations there. So I'm curious about how the idea for General Magic came about and what the vision was for it initially.
Well, it was really Mark Perret was the visionary. He hired on at Apple in 1988, where his job was to figure out what's the next thing beyond personal computers. He went and interviewed many Apple employees and other industry luminaries and put together this big, thick red book of designs to pursue. And did such a great job. He got a lot of people excited about it. And anyway, I got really excited mainly because it was a chance to work with Bill again. Bill called me up and said, oh boy, I ran across this incredible thing. It's going to be the future of the computer industry. Come back to Apple to work with me on it. And I said, oh, sounds interesting. The next day, Mark Perret came over to my house and showed me his models. One of the brilliant things Mark did to make it real was to make plaster models of what it could be like. And they looked very similar to the original iPhone. But, you know, with these models, you could really taste the potential and the future. And so I kind of signed up and I was not a very big John Sculley fan. And so I was pleased when in the spring of 1990, General Magic separated from Apple. It became its own little startup company funded by Apple, as well as the original investors in General Magic were Apple, Sony, and Motorola. All three very strategic. Sony, because they were the best consumer electronics manufacturer in the world. Motorola, who had the best wireless networking. Apple, who had the best user interface expertise. Those three together were the initial investors, but also customers of General Magic.
Yeah. General Magic, they created products and innovations that were really ahead of the time. And one of the major ones was the Magic Cap operating system.
Right.
What was the idea behind that?
We wanted to make it as easy as possible to learn and to use, very much like the Macintosh, but even more so because we had a broader consumer ambition. And so, again, the way you make something new is you just try things out. And so it evolved over a period of 3 or 4 years. We came up with using, you know, essentially building on top of the desktop metaphor from the Finder on the Mac. We had a spatial metaphor where a lot of your tools were on the desk, but we also had a hallway of doors to expand into and a street, quote unquote, where commercial services would be available. We also wanted it to be uniquely customizable. And of course, as always, we wanted to make it as fun and enjoyable and as lovable to use as we possibly could. So a mistake we made was we probably took too long doing it. We were both early and late. It's very, very important to get feedback from your intended users as you're doing it. That's why it probably would have made sense to do a more stripped down version first and build on top of that. On the other hand, General Magic was so many years ahead of the core technology it would need to really make a difference. So we were too early. We could have, if we started a few years later, we probably would have had a better chance to succeed. And then Apple decided, even though they were our benefactor and progenitor, they wanted to do their own thing with Newton. Newton was in development for 2 or 3 years before General Magic started. They were building something very different than General Magic. We were wanted to build something that fit in your pocket and was based on networking. Communication was its the center of the design. Whereas Newton had a full page display. They were supposed to, you know, General Magic's target price was about $500. Newton's, the original Newton I'm talking about, was more like $5,000. It was like inspired by the Dynabook, whereas General Magic was more inspired by the cell phone. But then when some of their plans Newton's plans didn't come to fruition, they made the fateful decision to switch gears and build something very much like what General Magic was building, something that could fit in your pocket, something that had a stylus. And that, of course, put us at odds with Apple. They were not as upfront as perhaps they should be. We were just blindsided. We didn't know they had changed the Newton to be directly competitive with Magic Hat. But they did, and that was disappointing. If Apple ended up joining forces and working together on something, it would have been a much better chance of succeeding. Both Newton and General Magic suffered from what happened.
We could have got the iPhone maybe a decade ahead of when we got it, maybe.
Yeah, except there were so many enabling technologies that weren't ready yet. You couldn't have the capacitive touchscreens back when we were doing it. You know, they came 5 years or more later. We had resistive touchscreens where you can't swipe as nicely. You know, it just couldn't have as good a feel as the iPhone. Plus, the processors weren't fast enough. The wireless networking was barely existing. You know, it's like orchestrating a ballet or something. You know, putting all the pieces together, you know, the six or seven different crucial technologies and having it all come together in the right time for shipping when you're planning. You know, you can't really pull that off perfectly, although I guess the iPhone came close to doing it.
Well, Andy, I'm conscious that you've already been extremely generous with your time. And, you know, we could talk to you all day, the amount of incredible stories that you've got. And obviously, we did touch on the fact that you have an amazing website that's been going over 20 years now, called folklore.org, that documents a lot of Apple history and a lot of the people involved as well, all in great short anecdotes, too. So where did the idea of doing that come from then, of setting the website up?
Well, I was interested. This was in... When did I start that? 2003. I had the idea to work on something that would allow collaborative storytelling. You know, I had seen other books about Apple, and they were all biased by the position the author was in. And I wanted to come up with a way to document important projects that wasn't biased. And so the idea I had was I called a collective historical storytelling or something like that, where anyone could or group could write, each person could write their own little stories that would add up to the big story. And so I developed the website or started developing the website when I thought, well, what story can I use to develop this with? And the obvious thing was the development of the Macintosh, which I was already really close to. So I started building the site and inviting key contributors to the Macintosh to submit their stories. I ended up with stories from Susan Kerr, Steve Capps, Bruce Horn, Don Denman. What I later found out, I thought the valuable thing of what I was doing was a software framework for collective storytelling. But the real value ended up being the stories themselves that I wrote. That's what people resonated with. You know, in a way, the project was a failure because I never got traction with many other stories like I initially intended. On the other hand, the Mac stories were worthwhile. We ended up spinning it out into a book, which I'm really glad happened. The book ended up being beautiful and a great thing to have. Yeah, well, some news, I guess, not that much news, but late last year, I got the Computer History Museum to take over the maintenance of the Folklore website. I started thinking, hey, I'm 71 years old. I don't know how much longer I'll be around. If I got it under the auspices of an institution, it'll last longer than I will. So I had to, in some ways, disembowel it to get it to be acceptable to the History Museum because they needed it not to have any maintenance. Because then I might not be around. If you do anything too fancy on the server side, it almost certainly will become obsolete in a few years as the rest of the site develops. So I had to freeze it. I had to take away the ability to add new stories, add comments and ratings. But with, you know, in that frozen state, it was ideal for the Computer History Museum. So I'm glad that worked out.
Yeah, I think it's in safe hands with them, absolutely.
Yes.
And but people can read the book. Actually, I'm looking at the Kindle version is available right now on Amazon. Revolution in the Valley.
Yes.
With the foreword by Steve Wozniak.
Yes.
Are the hardbacks still available for it?
Yeah, you can get them used.
Yeah, okay.
Just search for it. You know, they're all over the place. But yeah, it's out of print.
I'll put a link to the Kindle version in the show notes so people can buy it on Amazon.
Yes.
If they want to check it out. And of course, Folklore as well. That will be in the show notes too.
Yeah.
Andy, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you and some incredible stories that you've shared with us. So thanks again for coming on and doing some reminiscing with us. It's been an absolute honor to talk to you.
Okay, great. Thanks.